everybody. The House Judiciary Committee will please come to order. I'm acting chair today, Reverend Kelly, and she's after. She's out doing good things for the state of Alaska. Would you please call the roll?
Yes. Representative Grunberg?
Here.
Representative Foster? Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Glenn?
Here.
Representative Miller?
Here.
Representative Pruitt?
Here.
Representative Keller.
And Foster's here, thank you.
Okay. On today's agenda, we've got three bills that we're going to be considering. We've looked at a couple of them previously. First thing we'd like to do, though, Reverend Grunberg has a bill that I believe he would like to have the Judiciary Committee entertain putting in as a committee bill. I know nothing about it, but we will soon give it a very, 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 very brief, non-binding rendition of the bill, because we're not hearing the bill now. We'd just like to know what the subject is. And then when the chair returns to this seat Monday, he will look at it and he'll make a decision.
Okay, yeah. Does everybody have a copy of the bill? Yeah, this is entitled An Act Relating to the Crime of Unlawful Evasion. Have we distributed the blurb from the LAA book? Okay. If we should get that distributed.
What does the bill do, basically?
The bill cures a problem resulting from a particular case. The Court of Appeals held that you could not be prosecuted under Alaska law, under the escape statutes, if a person who was confined in a halfway house was transported to another facility and walked away from the van, that just fell between the cracks, and that it was the appellant had been released on parole and he was being transported to a community residential center in a police van. He opened the van door and left.
Was that in Palmer?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I'd have to look. He was charged with a parole violation and escape in the second degree. Because he wasn't in detention, he couldn't be prosecuted under that statute. So I asked Ledge Legal. They had recommended Ledge review, and Ledge Legal worked on this with the Department of Law and came out with this bill, which adds some provisions in evasion in the second degree, unlawful evasion, so that now somebody could be prosecuted, because they shouldn't be able to walk away from a van that's transporting them from one institution to another. It cures a loophole, and I asked that we just put it in the committee, because it's too late to do it.
And I assume you're talking Representative Keller, Chair Keller?
Yes, I have.
So he's familiar with it?
Yes, well, I think, would he want us to wait until Monday?
We're going to wait until Monday, because I'm not the chair, I'm the acting chair today.
Okay.
And so I appreciate you sharing it with the committee, and then when he comes back, I'll tell him, of course, that we had a very brief overview, and I thank you for that, and then he'll decide what to do with it.
That's fine.
The other problem that we have is it's not noticed on our...
Again, please?
It's not noticed today for our hearing, so...
Okay. Well, then, but he may decide Monday to say, I intend to hear this bill and we go through regular notification process, but that's his decision, again, not mine. So thank you very much.
Yeah, the only question was whether to put it in the committee name. That's the only question.
Well, there's no choice, because no bills are being heard, no personal bills are being heard now. It will be on the deadline. So only, I do not know what the committee bill deadline is. Anybody know here?
There is none.
I think there is one, actually.
There is none? Okay. Okay, with that, let's take out House Bill Bill 369 that has to do with immunity for drug overdose, and who is talking to that bill today? Yeah, do you want to hear it? It makes no difference to me.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I will go ahead and start from here, since it's already been introduced, and explain what we essentially have before this is we're going to want to, I'm going to want to move the version C of CS, which you guys should have availability of a copy. I know there's some behind me. And then, if it's okay, I'd like to discuss the changes. So,
Version C, you said?
Yeah.
I don't have a copy of version C, I don't think. Thank you. Do you folks have a copy of version C down there?
Of course I do.
Okay, we're all singing on the same sheet of music here. Okay, go ahead.
All right. So, Mr. Chair, I move CS, I bring forward the committee CS for House Bill 369. That would be 28-LS151-C.
I'll object for discussion purposes.
All right. Okay. Representative Miller, object for discussion purposes. Okay.
All right. Mr. Chair, so what I'll start is kind of a brief review, and I may bring Morgan up, who's been kind of my, actually Morgan, if you'll just come up, and then I'll start. What we've done here with this CS is there was some concern from the Department of Law, actually, on the immunity that we were discussing prior being a broad immunity, essentially meaning that if we were, if the person was becoming immune in that that interaction, so they were, let's say they had called 911 or they had dropped someone off, that they would be immune from really anything at that point. And that's not the point. That wasn't what we were trying to do. So working with the Department of Law, we came up with, I think gets to the point of what we're trying to do without bringing in those other issues. And that is a restriction on prosecution. And the restriction on prosecution is only related to the piece that we're talking about here, so that would be the personal possession. It wouldn't include things like if they open up the trunk of a car, the person's dropping someone off, or they're out there responding, the police are there, and they open up the trunk and find more than personal use, it looks like intent to distribute, they can still prosecute that intent to distribute. So what I'd like to do now, if that's okay, if Morgan, if you just talk to kind of exactly, and we've got Ms. Carpinetti, who can also speak to it, what we've done here, if need be, but yeah.
Okay, please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Through the chair, my name is Morgan Hobson. I'm staff to Representative Pruitt, and the representative very clearly did state the reason why we have this new CS before us. We have been working with the Department of Law to come up with a term that would be appropriate in this circumstance. It was brought to our attention that in Alaska, immunity may lead to transactional immunity, which would make it more difficult to prosecute any other charges other than possession that an officer may.
It was too broad before, and you narrowed the scope of it.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. We have Ms. Carpinetti here to explain those changes if anyone else would like clarification, although I believe I have spoken to the committee members.
And I do have Lieutenant Rodney Dial of the State Troopers online for questions or comments.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Any questions for her?
I'm going to ask other people these questions.
Okay, thank you. Just hang on there. Let's go to Lieutenant Rodney Dial next, and then we'll finish up with Ms. Carbonetti. Lieutenant Dial, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I am online.
Good afternoon. Introduce yourself, and please make your comments.
I'm sorry.
For the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with Alaska State Troopers. The department certainly understands the importance of creating an environment that supports the reporting of medical emergencies due to drug overdoses. We have reviewed the CS. We had some initial concerns that we addressed with the Department of Law, and we're waiting for some clarification on. One potential concern is that to obtain a search warrant for medical records to prove that an overdose did not exist under this legislation might require law enforcement to present evidence to a judicial officer that there is evidence of a particular crime or tends to show that a certain person has committed a crime. We're concerned that if the judicial officer believed that the person had immunity and that no crime was committed, law enforcement may have difficulty obtaining a warrant to determine if the immunity was justified initially. And then we think that the CS has addressed the other concern that we had initially. I'll just briefly comment on that one. That was that we were concerned that an astute drug dealer fearing a potential drug raid could proactively use an acquaintance to feign an overdose and report that prior to the raid, thereby obtaining immunity from the drug prosecution. We think that this probably addresses that, so that's not as much of a concern for the department anymore. And we do understand that this does not prevent us from charging other crimes that could be applicable, such as manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, assault, reckless endangerment, and so forth. And thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
And so, essentially, you believe that the CS resolves some of those concerns, and you're happy with this part of the CS at least?
Mr. Chairman, we are happy with the changes that the CS has made.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Lieutenant Dowell? Lieutenant Miller.
Hi, Lieutenant Dowell. It's good to hear from you. I just have a question about, so if someone reports a person with overdose, and we're offering them immunity, what would indicate that you would search that person or search that person's possession to see if they do have quantities of drug? How does that work in a case like this? So let's just say there's a man at someone's house, he overdoses, the man calls 911, the medical people respond. Does that give you access to that person's house to search and seize any illegal drugs? And then does the immunity go away if that happens?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, very hard to comment on as it would be a case-by-case situation. Generally, in past incidents where we've had somebody that's reported an overdose, the last thing that's on our mind is making an arrest at that point. We deal with the medical issue first. We contact the individuals that are in the house and start an investigation into how, you know, the drugs may have been obtained or ingested. And then we look if there's some other violation of law that's there. If we suspect that that person who may have called in that overdose is just a user or maybe had simple possession, there might not be anything that we would do with that individual, at least initially. There could be instances where we would discover drugs on that person as a protective safety search. So we would go in, and if we had some concerns with, you know, safety, we might do a pat down on individuals, and then sometimes we come across drugs in that manner. So it's really a case-by-case situation. Very hard to speculate or on how we would proceed.
Follow up. So does that, so what I'm getting at is if that person gives law enforcement access to their house to respond to a medical situation, do you have the right to search the house? Does that them opening the door and allowing you in, does that give you opportunity to search the house without a warrant because they have allowed you in?
I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Millett, generally not. If we saw something in plain view, that would be an exception to the search warrant requirement. However, if we felt that in a back bedroom there might be a large quantity of drugs, really our only options at that point would be to ask for permission to go back there or to go before a court and seek a warrant to go back there.
Of course, by the time you got the warrant, the drug bedroom would be emptied.
Well, follow up. Well, my concern is if you're responding to a place that there's a meth lab in and the person is overdosed on meth, and then you go in and you discover that there's a meth, you know, that there's a meth lab on the premises, and the person reporting is asking for immunity because he saved a person's life, but yet he's, you know, in this back room he's got a meth lab, and then he gets off scot-free.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, that could potentially happen. We would have to consult with the Department of Law and our district attorney on what steps we'd have to take at that point. Generally, if we respond to a resident and currently and we noticed evidence of a meth lab, that would be plain view. At that point, what we do is process the medical emergency, and then in consultation with the district attorney's office, probably get a warrant anyway, just to be on the safe side, and then process the scene for the illegal meth lab.
Follow up.
So the immunity wouldn't be extended to that person that reported the victim, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, currently there would be no immunity under this legislation. That would be a decision that we would have to address with the Department of Law and our district attorney's office as to whether or not that would exceed some threshold of personal possession that would be immune under this legislation.
Well, to follow up? There's no personal possession of meth allowed by law. But I guess what I'm saying is, if a known, my fear is if there's a known drug dealer and has an overdose at his house, and in the back of his house he's got a meth lab, it's not invisible, plain sight, but you've had other calls of saying that he's suspected of being a dealer, how long would it take you to get a warrant to search the premises?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, in many cases we can get a warrant telephonically if we need to. If we think that it's going to take a while to get a warrant, a lot of times what we can do is secure the scene by having everybody vacate the residence and then just secure the house while officers will go before a judge and get a warrant.
Okay, thank you.
I believe you smell a meth lab many times, right?
He said if it was in plain sight.
Yeah. Would that include smelling it? No, I'm serious.
I know, but I don't know. I mean, that's why I'm confused on this point.
Okay. Reverend, I'm going to let you break in here since you're about, then Reverend Ledoux.
Yeah, and actually Morgan may be able to answer this better, but what that doesn't change their ability to go after the meth lab itself, because that's actually the change we made here, is that immunity is no longer transactional. It does not make the whole thing immune. So they would still be able to take care of that. And I'll let Morgan answer if she's going to spend more time on this, actually.
Well, just for clarification, what I'm worried about is an unlawful search and seizure, because you've allowed someone to come in your house for a medical response, and then that becomes not allowed in the court proceeding, that because you came in for a medical reason and then you did an illegal search and seizure in the house, that would be, Annie can probably answer that question, but that would be deleted from prosecution. That illegal search and seizure would be deleted from, would not be evidence that would be able to be used in the prosecution. And that's what I'm getting at.
Okay, let's go to Morgan right now.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I may be able to address some of those concerns. As Representative Pruitt was saying, in this version we take out immunity, so there's, instead of immunity, we have offered a restriction from prosecution. And so the only thing that this would protect against is possession. And if a police officer did enter the premise and have an inclination that there was more, they would indeed still be able to prosecute on that. But if they did not have any indication that there may be something else going on that they could take the person in for, then no, they would not have any ability to go after that under this.
Thank you. Representative Foster?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if somebody, and this is for Lieutenant Dial, you've got person A and person B. Person A calls for medical assistance, and because person B is overdosing, and that person is granted some kind of restricted immunity. Now, say person A is a person who gave person B the drugs and provided them with the paraphernalia and everything. Could that person be charged with reckless endangerment in that situation?
Representative Foster, through the chair, that is possible. We would look at a number of charges. It could be reckless endangerment. It could be assault. The person died, potentially criminally negligent homicide. So there's a number of different charges that we can use currently to address that.
Thank you.
Very fine. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask the staff, do you have any legal memorandums or opinions that you've received on this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, for this particular change, we don't have a legal memorandum yet. This one just came to us this morning, but we do have the drafter online and available to answer questions, and that is Catherine Strassbaugh.
What is the drafter's name?
Catherine Strassbaugh.
Do you have any legal memorandum?
Who is the drafter again?
It was Kathleen Strassbaugh.
Okay. Go ahead, Reverend.
Do you have any legal memoranda or opinions on previous versions of this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, I would have to check to make sure I had my bills and bill versions straight to speak to that, but I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, I would appreciate it if it's okay with the bill sponsor that you do that and distribute to us any memoranda you've received.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, I think, is unusually drafted because it's drafted as a restriction on prosecutorial discretion. It basically says the prosecutor may not, the district attorney, attorney general, may not exercise their discretion whether or not to prosecute for a particular crime, several crimes. And we haven't seen that. And I'm kind of asking the bill sponsor or any of the other attorneys as they come up to comment on that in view of a case that I'll have distributed called Public Defender versus Superior Court, which states that the court doesn't have the power to control the exercise of the Attorney General's discretion as to whether they'll take action in any particular case. That's a separation of powers issue. And I think this gets into the same problem, and I'm wondering why this kind of language was chosen when it could have been drafted differently to provide that this would be a defense to the crimes. Clearly we can do that, and it would seem to me it would be constitutionally cleaner to do it that way. And if we go that route, my question would be whether this should be an affirmative defense and how we can craft that constitutionally, not throwing the burden unconstitutionally on the defendant when the prosecution has the burden of proof. But I'm wondering why it was done in this manner and whether we could do it the other way, which would be clearly constitutional, because these should be elements of an affirmative defense. No, I didn't possess it. What I was doing was just trying to get this guy some help. I litigated an issue like this years ago where the defense to a possession of heroin was I took the heroin from the person who gave it to me and took it to the other room to flush it down the toilet. The jury didn't believe my client in that case, but there's a line of California cases that allows that, and there's another Alaska Supreme Court case dealing with that, and I'm wondering, that's a long question, whether you through the chair, whether you explored any of these other possibilities. Why don't you
let me ask sponsor of the bill.
I have an answer.
Representative
thank you, Mr. Chair. Affirmative defense was actually the initial suggestion from the Department of Law. And I'll admit I have the pushback against that because my concern, what we're trying to get at here is to have the individual that's assisting the person who is overdosing not have to go through their mind, if I help my friend, am I automatically going to have to lawyer up? The goal was to find a man. That's why you find this very this different draft of it. It is unique, manner that we've addressed this year, because I don't want people thinking, and actually I think Representative Millett mentioned this the first time the bill was heard, I don't want that person to have to think in their mind, do I help my friend or do I leave him in the gutter, because I don't want to deal with the legal mess. And that's kind of what this, that's why we asked them to find another manner of addressing that issue, of not giving the broad immunity, but still getting to the point where the possession aspect, and of course the first section of their restriction on prosecution for certain persons connection with the drug, they're not because prosecuted. If you look at those violations, they're drug-related violations, so it would not prohibit, or there's no restriction on prosecution for, say, assault or some of the other things that take place. It's just on that possession aspect of it. So that if there's, basically this is getting at the friend of the person who OD'd, who was joining their friend and having, you know, they were having fun or whatnot, and the friend gets ODs and they're sitting here saying, I want to help my friend, that they don't have to think about the fact that they have a little bit of drugs on them or they have some paraphernalia on them, that they can help their friends, and it's really to save their life at that point.
Mr. Chair. Brief response, and then Representative Ladue, you never did get your initial question in.
No, I didn't, and then I have another question, too.
Well, you can do both.
Thank you.
Representative, then we're going to Representative Ladue.
I see what you're saying. I'm going to ask that this other opinion be distributed when we visit this lawmaker. We can look at it. And I'm not sure if the way it's phrased is going to be constitutional or not. I don't have any problem with what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
But what you want to do is to allow something to be basically dismissed immediately. We just need to get some answers.
Yeah.
That gets you off the hook.
Okay, Representative Ladue.
Okay, the first question I was going to ask is, when a person calls 911 and says, hey, we've got an emergency here, my friend's OD'd. I mean, do the police come out, wouldn't normally the ambulance come out?
And sometimes, of course, the police accompany the ambulance.
Can I answer that?
Yes.
Okay. So actually, and if you should have the available, they should be available at one of the many documents that's available on this. But we had Ledge Research to look into that, and actually the best example that we came up with is what the state of Washington's done. They have something similar to this. In 2010, they implemented theirs, and their example is they found that in just about every case where there was an overdose, it was along with the medical personnel. Came police, and actually one point I'll actually highlight was that they had about 60 something percent, I can't remember the exact number, of police officers responded that in most cases they would not prosecute the individual, or even the individual that did not have, you know, they weren't dealing, basically that friend essentially. So already there's some discretion, and I think Lieutenant Dial mentioned that the discretion that they have. What we're getting at is, while they have that discretion, the other piece that we learned through this, through the research, is that 50% of people would call no matter what if their friend had a problem. But it moved to 88% when they recognized that they themselves wouldn't find themselves in a legal bind. So you actually had an increase in people that were willing to make that call and try to save their friend, because now they knew that, okay, I'm not going to, because there's that automatic fear that if I call, the police are going to get me, even though the police might not do that. So it's essentially taking street law and making it actual law. That's kind of what it comes down to.
So follow up, and then...
Follow up.
Okay. So if you called and said, hey, my friend's dying of a heart attack, the police don't show up, just the ambulance shows up. But if you say it's an OD, then all right, got that. Okay, so then my second question is, and I have no idea whether Representative Grunberg's concern about the separation of powers, I haven't read this case, so I don't know whether it's mandated or not, but I really, really like this bill. So I want to get it right. And so I was thinking, how would it work if you said instead of a person may not be prosecuted for an offense, if you simply say a person is not guilty of an offense under this chapter if? So that was going to be my suggestion.
Well,
if necessary.
I don't think you're guilty or innocent, are you, until after you arrested and a court comes to a decision.
Yeah.
Am I missing something?
This kind of goes where the three of you are. I support the idea that somebody shouldn't have to fear an unjust prosecution. But from the point of view of the prosecutor and the police, all they'll have at first is the person's statement, oh, I didn't have the drug, I did it to save my buddy. They would probably still investigate and possibly prosecute until they learned the truth. So it's unlikely that unless there was clearly no involvement, that they would be doing something. As in the real world, they're unlikely just to take this guy's assertion point blank. And anyway, just put that out there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I don't disagree with you on that, Representative Grunberg, that there would definitely, I would expect that the responding officers would continue to dig a little bit more to understand if there was more at play and under, that would make sense to me, honestly, so.
That's where police officers, you know, the greatest quality of police officers, not a score in their pistol ring, is common sense. Any comments then? Yes, Representative Duke.
One more follow-up. If one did not like is not guilty of, you could say a person has not committed the crime of, something like that.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah. Any follow-up? We have Annie Carvinetti. Just to let you know, I have Catherine Strassbaugh, alleged legal, on the phone. I think she helped draft the bill, and then we have, of course, Quinlan Stein, public defender. He is online to give us some help if we need it. And I think, as I said, of course, Annie Carbonetti, our trustworthy advisor, is here, worked with her for years. And any comments you'd like to make, you know, you can stay there, and if you like, and call somebody else up.
Through the chair, I might make one comment just to explain how we did reach this decision. It is indeed a balance of the ability and the mood, how to prosecute this, and balancing out how the public will perceive this as far as their protection if they call in. The reason that we did not choose to go with an affirmative defense, as Representative Pruitt stated, is that the person would be assuming that they would have to go to court to defend themselves no matter what if they called in. And so by drafting it this way, we hoped that their immediate reaction would be, I can call in because I am safe from this possession charge that I might otherwise be subject to. And with that, I would turn over the chair to Ms. Carbonetti.
Let's call Ms. Carbonetti. Are you ready to share your wisdom? Afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Annie Carbonetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I want to thank Representative Pruitt for working with us on this bill. We appreciate the changes that have been made so far. It was our suggestion, and it still is, that we would much prefer it to be an affirmative defense rather than a bar to prosecution. And the reason is that the information that is part of this, for example, whether or not a person sought in good faith to have the police come, whether in fact it was a real overdose and not something that was manufactured to avoid avoid prosecution of a drug dealer. All these various pieces of information are in that really the hands of the person being charged. They have their medical records. They know whether they are acting in good faith. The way it's drafted now, and we really appreciate it that it's not immunity. That is a huge improvement for us because immunity means some things that to judges and prosecutors and defendants that is not necessary to address here. But for an affirmative defense, the state would the person claiming the defense would have the burden by a preponderance of the evidence, which is the lowest burden in our law, to prove that these various factors, for example, he or she was acting in good faith to avoid to obtain help for a person who was experiencing an overdose, or if that was the person who experienced the overdose. The way it's drafted now, the prosecution would have to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that these facts existed, which would be difficult under the circumstances, which is why we would really prefer an affirmative defense. And I will say also, I have not read the decision that you have referenced, and I would like the opportunity to do so. As you described it, you said the court doesn't have the power to limit the Attorney General's discretion. I'd like to read the case, but this is the legislature that would be limiting the Attorney General's discretion, and that's what you do all the time when you adopt laws. You set standards and differences in what is against the law and what is not. But having said that, I would like to read the decision and see.
Fine. I'd like to I guess you'd come back, Reverend Ledoux may have to go to Senate, has to testify on something there, so that's why she's not here right now, I think. If not now, it'll be later. Representative Gordberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do this all the time, and I guess you could say that every time we say something is not a crime, that is a bar, but we don't term it in the way this is. Mm-hmm. This, I think, may cause needless confrontation, which I would like to avoid.
Well, certainly I would too, Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, and I just want to let you all know that our preference would be to have it as an affirmative defense, because that would avoid some of the concerns that...
May I follow up, please?
Follow up, and then we're going to Representative Millett.
I don't know if the members are completely familiar with how an affirmative defense would work in this case. Maybe you could walk us through procedurally how that would work into this bill.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, for an affirmative defense, there has to be some evidence that there are facts supporting the affirmative defense, and then the person claiming the affirmative defense, which is the defendant in a criminal prosecution, has the burden of proof by a preponderance of evidence as to whether or not he or she has established that affirmative defense.
And just if I may briefly.
Quickly.
So the issue goes to the jury first, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, yes, but of course when we are screening cases, as our DAs are screening the cases, if they are aware of the facts that that the person called and reported it to medical authorities, that would be something that our prosecutors would take into account before even charging.
And a final question, if I may. Is there any constitutional problem with establishing an affirmative defense that flips the burden from the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt to the defendants to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence? Is that okay constitutionally?
Through the chair, we have several affirmative defenses in our law which have been upheld, so I believe it is okay.
I just wanted to put that on the record.
Reverend Millett.
Thank you. So, Hannah, my question goes back to, someone calls in, and I think you heard my explanation before. What are the search and seizure rules under that if there it is a drug dealer and they do have a large quantity of drugs? They call thinking that this law gives them basically, immunity from prosecution. But there's,
Well, let me just expand on what Lieutenant Dial said, because he was correct. The medical personnel and if a law enforcement officer goes into the house to assist the individual having having an overdose, medical problems, as Lieutenant Dial said, if there were, for example, they're there on the living room, on the coffee table where the person is sitting, there are scales and large amounts of controlled substances, that would be within, in plain view, because the officers had a legal right to be where they were observing that evidence. So that I believe, would be okay for them to seize and for us to use as evidence. If the evidence is in the back bedroom, as Lieutenant Dial explained, it really depends on the circumstances. If there's an we can now, officers can now get a search warrant over the telephone so that they could call a judge and explain what they consider to be probable cause and have the judge evaluate that evidence to determine whether there is sufficient evidence to issue a search warrant, and that could be issued for a back bedroom. And it really depends on the facts and the circumstances of the case. And as Lieutenant Dial said, if it was compelling, they could secure the scene and wait for the search warrant to be granted, either by telephone or...
And as long as they obtain... Follow-up? And as long as they obtain a warrant legally, that would be admissible in court as evidence. I guess what I'm worried about is collecting evidence under a search and seizure law, you know, violating a search and seizure law to get that evidence, and then it being disallowed in the court case against the...
Well, if for example, it was in a closed back bedroom when there was there was sufficient probable cause for the officers to obtain a search warrant from a judicial officer, and that and the officers searched the room pursuant to the warrant, I don't see any reason why, at this point, under the circumstances, why we could not use that evidence in a prosecution for for a meth lab or something like that.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux.
So, if you're the resident of an apartment which has a meth lab in it, and so the police are in the front room, but they don't have probable cause to go back into the back bedroom without a search warrant. Mm-hmm. So they get on their telephones to try to get a search warrant. Can you tell them to leave the house so that you can, like, flush everything down the toilet while they're getting the search warrant?
Through the chair, you could tell them, but they wouldn't have to do that.
They don't, even if they don't have any probable cause to be in your house at the moment.
Well, they have probable cause to get into the house because they were invited into the house.
They were invited, but yes. You can't uninvite them? I mean, once... No,
that's a good question. I'm just thinking about the circumstances.
Can't you then say, okay, your permission here is terminated? Get out of my house?
Through the chair, you could say that, but depending on the circumstances, the officers could say, we have reason to believe that there's illegal activity on the premises. We are consulting judicial authorities. I think they would be able to stay and secure the premises as Lieutenant Dial suggested.
All right, thank you.
And, well, I'll pass. Go ahead and say, Ms. Carpenter. Let's get Kathleen Strasbaugh, Let's Legal, online, please. Are you there?
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself, and I'd like to have you make any comments you like, and particularly as it pertains to the testimony given by Annie Carpenetti and the comments by Representative Bernberg and Representative Ledoux and maybe others.
Kathleen Strasbaugh, Legislative Legal Services. I don't really have anything to add. If the sponsor wishes, I can read out what's in the Washington case and offer another couple of ways to address the issue of non-prosecution, but basically I don't really have anything to add to the testimony.
By the... Bill Sponsor, everything Pruitt is nodding his head in the affirmative.
Okay. The way that the state of Washington has stated their provision is as follows. A person acting in good faith who seeks medical assistance for someone experiencing a drug-related overdose shall not be charged or prosecuted for possession. Use the passive tense, but use the terms shall not be charged or prosecuted. And then another option that is sometimes used in our statutes is a non-applicability provision. I would agree with Ms. Carpinetti that because the legislature makes laws with respect to what may or may not be prosecuted, that there's not a constitutional interference in the manner of the case described by Representative Greenberg, in which the court took it upon itself to tell the prosecutor whether or not they would bring a case, wanted to force them essentially to bring a case, and the court did not have a role in deciding, making that decision. But it wasn't really quite the same, and I have to agree with Ms. Carpinetti on that issue.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Please hang around. We have a little bit to go, I think.
I have one question.
Reverend
Miller. So in this situation of being able to legally possess marijuana in your house, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
3 ounces or 1 ounce or whatever.
Amount for personal use.
Amount for personal use. I think that actually defines the amount. But so if that is in common sight, that wouldn't be seized. Is that what I'm assuming? That because it's for personal use and it's under the amount allowed by law, and it miraculously got there?
Through the chair, I that's my assumption. All these things depend on circumstances, but with no other facts there, that would be my assumption too, that there was no grounds for arrest because nobody was violating the law.
And then would the marijuana be seized?
Through the chair, I don't think so, no. I don't see why it would be. Is that it?
Did you find anything?
Oh, I was just looking for this amount because.
Did you find it?
If you'd like me to check,
I don't know what this is. According to the note I received from my staff, it says Raven versus State of AK or A, what A something, 4 ounces is legal.
So it's you, yes.
Did that answer that? Reverend Ledoux.
Didn't we make any amount illegal back in 2005 or 2006? We did something back then.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, that sounds familiar to me, but it was not an issue that I was involved in, so I would have to refresh my recollection to advise you on that.
Anything else?
No,
Thank you. Quinn Steiner, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, this is Quinn Steiner.
Speak up, please. I think you're online, but I can't. Quinn
Steiner.
Hello. We're just getting a snippet of what you're saying. Or, in order to put it about a smidgen of what you're saying.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Yes, this is Clement Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, you heard the ongoing conversations here. Do you have anything you'd like to weigh in on that, particularly, you know, as your position as a public defender?
No, I don't really have any particular comments, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very fine. Wayne? Another note here. Okay. any other questions? Thank you very much, sir. Hang around. Is there anybody else on the line who would like to testify? Anybody else in the room who would like to testify? If not, I'm going to close public testimony and read to the committee for discussion. Any discussion among the members of the
Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection for adopting the CS on House Bill 369.
Any objection?
I'm removing my objection.
I mean, any objection to removing? Okay. Okay. So we're going to move the bill? Yes, Reverend Newberg. I think you missed the boat here.
No, she was just removing her objections to adopting the CEO.
Okay, fine. Good. We got, you are correct. Moving over that over there, okay?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Reverend Millett.
I would like to move CS, House Bill 369-28-LS151-C from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Mr. Chair,
from committee.
Any objection?
Yeah, I wanted to.
So just say yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. I think it's probably not a restriction on prosecution. The style is different than we normally use, and I think it's important to stick with the kinds of style that prosecutors and police are used to in this state. Apparently in the state of Washington, their drafting style may be a bit different. And I think it's clearer if it's styled as an affirmative defense. You don't think so?
Oh. Reverend.
Through the chair, I think that styling something as an affirmative defense puts the kid who wants to call somebody to help his friend into the position of having to go to court, even if he ultimately beats the rap, so to speak. I think the intention of this bill is to let it be known on the street, so to speak, hey, you know, if you're there and somebody's OD'd, call the cops and you're not going to go to jail. And that's...
Or go to court. That's, yeah.
And so, I mean, maybe the style, through the chair again, I mean, maybe the style is a little bit different, but if the Department of Law doesn't have any problem with it and isn't going to go to court in order to try to say that it's unconstitutional or, you know, that they have problems with it, the defendant sure isn't going to, so let's just leave it. That's kind of my thought on it.
Well, I'm more concerned with substance than I am style.
Mr. Chair.
And
the reason that I like the drafting of this legislation is, let's take someone who is on probation and they make the call and they have to go before court. It could be a violation of their probation. I think this would make sure that that wouldn't be a violation of their probation by reporting someone that had an overdose. If I am reading the bill right, they would not be in violation of their probation because they have...
I'm sorry, through the chair, Mr. Chairman, my name is Annie Carpinetti and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. It says may not be prosecuted for a violation of the possession statutes. It doesn't say you can't be prosecuted for a probation violation, but it certainly... that's what it says. So,
Follow up, and then Reverend will do.
Thank you. So, if they're not being prosecuted, if they're not being taken to court, what would the violation be? I mean, they're saving someone's life. So, I guess if a condition of their bail was that they couldn't be around someone using drugs, then that would be a probation violation. Is that what you're saying? Depending on the conditions of probation?
It really depends on the circumstances. As Lieutenant Dial testified, rarely do police officers arrest people on the scene of a medical emergency like an overdose. So it depends on the circumstances. But it says you may not be prosecuted for possession of these drugs. It doesn't say that it could not be used as a basis for petition to revoke probation.
Okay, Reverend Ledoux.
What language would you recommend putting into it so that we cover that circumstance?
Mr. Chairman, I never write things down on the fly. It's just too—it's too important in criminal law to get it right. I just couldn't help you right now. I'm happy to go back to my office and come back and give you my best suggestions, but I just couldn't do it right here. I'm sorry.
Can I ask real quick, Eddies?
Yes. Eddies? We're back on the record.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, just as a matter of just process discussion here, we had a motion to move the bill, and then we had a motion, an objection to speak to your objection, right? And we started to discuss a little bit more about the bill than maybe even the objection. So at this point, if it's okay, I'd actually ask Representative Millett to withdraw her motion to move so that we can continue with the discussion that we're having.
Chair, I rescind my action on moving the CS for House Bill 369.
Okay, your motion has been rescinded. We're back in, I suppose, a committee discussion. Representative Grunberg.
I agree that you can't just draft on the fly, and that's at least just one issue here. The other issue is, let us say that the normal course of events, the person is arrested, or it appears that there's been possession, and the police are there, and he says, no, I just have this, I'm taking my buddy to, I turned it in to help my buddy. And then they're investigating. At that point, if there were questions about the veracity of his story, they would take the issue to trial. And it seems to me that the way this is drafted is ambiguous. It's not clear from the text of this, my question to you, through the chair, is it clear from the text of this that this would be an affirmative defense? I think it's ambiguously drafted. And if there's a question whether it's an affirmative defense or an element of the crime of some type, might not the court apply the rule of leniency, and not make it an affirmative defense, but in some manner make it an element of the crime? Isn't this somewhat unclear the way this is drafted?
Ms. Carbonetti.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I think it's not unclear. I think it's clear that it's not an affirmative defense the way it is drafted now. And I think that this evidence would be treated as if they were elements of the offense, that we would have to this evidence would be treated like a defense, like self-defense or various other defenses that the prosecution has to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Through the chair, Fong, so long.
One more follow-up.
So long as the defendant introduced some evidence to put the issue in play.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Fine. Reverend Pruitt, any comments at this point?
Mr. Chair, I don't, and I would like, though, if we could I just want to follow up on Representative Millett's question, and it might be something that we need to, I don't know, maybe Quinlan or something. The probation discussion, and of course, it almost seems like that's the policy call on our part of whether or not we wanted to include some sort of safe harbor in probation. If you could, your thoughts on including a discussion about probation, is that something that maybe, anyway, your thoughts just initially on hearing that? I mean, that was actually kind of the first time I'd actually thought about that piece too. Are we stretching too far? Maybe getting into something that we don't want to get into potentially. Your thoughts,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pruitt. That's a really difficult question because you've got somebody on probation who should be trying to avoid using drugs. I'm assuming it's a condition of his or her probation not to use a controlled substance, and the person is probably not doing very well on probation, as question of that person's well-being, you might not want to add any sort of prohibition on bringing a PTR in regard to that conduct. I guess I'd like to think about it.
Does that go to the heart of this bill, yay or nay?
Mr. Chairman, the heart of the bill says we can't prosecute for possessory offenses that are B and C felonies and A and B misdemeanors. So that's what it does. It just addresses possession of these of controlled substances.
Very narrow.
Well, it's narrow in the world of drug prosecutions.
World of narrow. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Well, I guess my question is that when someone's on probation and they're with another person and they're not knowingly aware that this person is doing drugs and then becomes the victim of an overdose, it's a disincentive for someone on probation to call unless they're also not charged with their restriction to criminal prosecution or an offense against their probation. I would assume that there's situations like that someone on probation could be with another person and not know that they're taking drugs. And so my concern is that we should probably add some safe harbor for someone that is on probation for, and I'm not talking, for large crimes. I'm talking about, smaller crimes that have probation attached to it that, maybe they're trying to save this person. Maybe they've gone through drug rehab and they're on probation and they're trying to go do an intervention on their buddy and he has an overdose. Mm-hmm. And he's actually doing a good deed, but in some case it would violate his probation, then he would also be prosecuted along.
Are you saying no good deed goes unpunished?
Well, that's the crux of it. And so I would think that we would want to continue the good behavior for the person on probation that's trying to do the right thing. I mean, it's a policy call. I'm just bringing it up because it's something.
What then would
do? And I'd say we'd want to do it for even the person on probation that is doing the wrong thing. Because I think what we want to do in this bill, I mean, you got to balance things. And I mean, I err on balancing to save a life.
Yep.
And I think that what's great about this bill is the idea of getting word out on the street, hey dude, call, you ain't gonna get into any trouble.
I agree with you. To me, this is really a pro-life bill. It's what it's all about. And if we pass this bill, we're going to be responsible around this table for saving somebody's life, probably more than one.
But Mr. Chairman, we don't want to put someone who's doing a good deed back in prison because they violated their probation by being next to someone.
By being a good Samaritan.
Being a good Samaritan in a bad situation that they didn't create on their own.
Totally agree. Discussion. Are you ready for a motion, Representative Millett?
Actually, I'd just like to ask the
spotties.
Yes, but we don't want to get to the substance of the bill and the headies. Headies.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Court.
So, and actually, I'd actually like to get a sense of the whole committee, to tell you the truth, on that particular issue. I'd appreciate it.
Right, so would you recommend just go on the table?
Well, I'd actually like to kind of get an idea if this is something that people are interested in including, because I don't want to start working on it and then have that become a portion that someone objects to.
I agree.
In the movement of the bill, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, we need to get it right. We can't. We'll never make this bill perfect, but we need to get it as good as we can at this level of the hearing process.
Right. Well, it would go, Mr. Chair. This would be the last committee referral on this particular bill. So.
And on this side of the house.
On this side. Yes, so correct. In this body.
Okay. You've been wisely silent so far. any comments?
I support the effort here. I don't want to stall the bill either. And so I would be okay with either of us, if we want to just hold it now work on it, add the language. It can also be brought back next year too. So I would defer to the sponsor of the bill, but I do support the language though.
I mean, you support the language as it is at this moment?
Adding in the language.
Adding in the language. Okay.
But again, I don't want to stall the bill either, so.
I think this has to be carefully drafted because somebody could be on probation for an entirely different crime. And many, many cases, in fact, I think Annie could correct me if I'm wrong, maybe even most of the cases involve PTRs, petition to revoke probation. And it almost always is brought with the new charge. And since you're only exempt from these particular new charges, it's we've got to have some consideration of whether we're going to exempt any PTRs that result from this, or just drug-related or something. And I think that we need to know really what we're doing here. I'm not suggesting we delay this or anything, but certainly it's a Friday afternoon and it's worth thinking about. And the other thing I am concerned about, folks, is what she said was, Ms. Carpinetti,
okay.
What she said was, if there's any doubt in the police's mind, they're going to continue the investigation, and then the question is going to become how this will be interpreted. And there's a very, I respectfully think that if she thinks it's clear from this that it would be an element of the crime, as long as there's some evidence that's put in, that the burden then remains on the prosecution to disprove this beyond a reasonable doubt. Under the way this is drafted, and you want to have it workable, it needs to be an affirmative defense to put the burden on the defendant who would have the knowledge. I realize you're shaking your head, but that's the way it would play out in many of these cases. It's not just going to be don't do it, but we have to consider how this will work in a court of law if the thing goes forward.
Okay. But I'm going to go with the Millis for comment.
Thank you.
Comment.
Okay.
Rebut anything you'd like to say. Well, and comment. Then I'm going to go to Representative Ledoux.
Okay.
Then I'm going to go to the bill sponsor. And then we'll make a decision what we're going to do. Representative Millis.
I do not want an affirmative action because I don't want the incentive here is to have a life saved. Okay? That to me, this is a life-saving bill. And to put the burden on the person that reported the overdose to have to prove that they weren't involved in it is a disincentive for someone to call and ask a medic to show up to save a life. That is my take on this bill. When you add the burden of proof on the defendant, you are disincentivizing this bill. It basically, to me, that would gut the bill. When it comes to the probation portion, I think that we could have a rules meeting if we wanted to talk. I don't want to slow down the bill either because I think this is a life-saving bill. Matter of fact, there was just a man that overdosed in behind the Lucky Wishbone, and if someone had reported that he was there, maybe his life could have been saved. So I think it's imperative that we pass this bill this session because I don't want anybody else dying of an overdose because their friends are scared of being prosecuted. That is my opinion only. So I would like to move the bill, and if the sponsor sees fit to add some type of probation protection or safe harbor for probationary reportants, that would be great. If not, I still think we have time in the Senate to do that. It's a worthy discussion to have, but I want to save lives because people are dying in the streets today.
Okay. Reverend Ledoux and then Acting Vice Chair and sponsor of the bill.
I don't want to hold up the bill. I think we do need to do something about the probation. Maybe, and maybe the sponsor would be interested in doing something about the probation in either the Rules Committee or on the House floor or over on the other side. But I actually think that, I mean, so many kids who are going to be around this sort of thing are probably going to likely be on probation. So I think if you don't, at some point before this bill becomes law, add in the probation element, then the bill is not nearly going to be as effective as it would be. I will defer to the sponsor whether he wants to try to do things now or whether he wants to do things somewhere else along the line, but that's my two cents.
Yeah. Would, in your comments, would you state that you would or would not like to add something either in House rules or on the House floor or in some committee down the hall?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I'd like to thank the committee for the robust debate on this. I mean, I think this has probably been, ironically enough, one of the best conversations that we've had this year, to tell you the truth.
Well, I work with the chairman.
There you go. and I don't mean to say that because it's my bill either, Mr. Chairman. It's just because I think this is kind of a unique scenario that we're addressing here, and I think we can all understand the what we're trying to get to. So I really appreciate the conversation. Not understanding the full capacity at this point in time of what the discussion on the probation aspect would be, my only concern would be that, as some of the other members have talked about, the movement of this bill. So, because I know at least this piece is, to me, is one element of it that I'd like to at least make sure gets through this year, and we are kind of running against the end of the session, which kind of makes this...
Everything.
Yeah, everything kind of, okay, do we try to move and make sure everything's included, or do we make sure that we at least have this one piece, and either, as the process is continuing, try to address that other piece, or maybe even make a commitment myself to analyze it, see if it's something that we can address and bring it back next year. And I think what I'd probably indicate is I'd like to see this go ahead and move with the commitment that we will, my staff, and I'm committing, Morgan's back there, and she's probably taking notes, and she's, hopefully she won't curse my name later, but she's shaking her head no, but others are shaking yes. but we'll take a look at that piece as it continues through the legislature even this year. And if we find that it's something that becomes overly complicated that will potentially damage this, then I would ask that you allow us to kind of work on it during the interim and come back next year and see if it's something that we can address. It's a good point, and it adds to the conversation, but not knowing how broad and potentially, because you're dealing with different statutes and different scenarios, I don't want to potentially derail what I think is one piece of this that's really good from continuing through the process. So, Mr. Chair?
I agree with the comments just been made. Do you want to move the bill?
I would love to move the bill.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of this bill.
Okay. Well, do something. Move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move CS House Bill 369/28/LS1515/C from committee with individual recommendations and a zero fiscal note from committee.
Any objection? No objection. The bill passes. Congratulations, everybody. Again, it has been a very, very good hearing. We're going to take a short at ease while we all catch our breath here and do the paperwork. State, but the House Judiciary Committee will please come back to order. Appreciate the good, robust discussion on the previous bill. We'll now be going to another exciting piece of legislation, and that would be House Bill 235. That's an act requiring the Alaska Public Officers Commission, commonly known as APOC, to maintain the confidentiality of certain proceedings, documents, and information. And so, who's here to testify on that bill?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Everybody identify yourself. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Thomas Stuttler. I'm staff for Representative Pete Higgins from District 5. And Representative Higgins would like to thank the committee today for hearing this bill on Alaska Public Officers, Public Offices Commission. And unfortunately, he's not able to be with us today because he's actually in the operating room performing surgeries today.
Performing surgery?
Yes. He's not being operated on. He's operating on somebody else.
Somebody else. I thought maybe he was working at APOC on a complaint or something.
No.
That's off the record. Go ahead.
Well, you left me so much room there, sir. Thank you. On the sponsor statement for this bill, you know, as Representative so put so appropriately in the last committee, you come into this world with your name, and it's the one thing you have to defend, and it's and only you can really give that up and to protect your good name in what you do. In Alaskans here, you know, we expect our officials to adhere to a strict set of laws and ethics, but unfortunately, those same laws don't apply to all. HB 235 would change that, and it's unfortunate that the legislature didn't include the Alaska Public Offices Commission, APOC, when it strengthened its ethics disclosure laws in the past decade. If it had, I don't believe that we would currently be in the hyper-politicized campaign era that we experience today. HB 235 requires the Commission to maintain confidentiality of their proceedings, documents, and information until the Commission establishes that a violation of the Alaska statutes has been determined. That is the same standard that we in the legislature are held to. That's the same standard that the executive branch are held to. And it ensures that the process has been followed with no undue influence or unneeded rush to judgment. The Commission performs a vital service to the people of the state, and we recognize the need to have the findings open to the public once the facts are known. And they have been determined that there has been a violation. This legislation does not detract from APOC's missions, its duties, nor its responsibilities. And the public will still be informed, and more importantly, they'll have access to the record once those facts are indeed known. It's unfortunate that this process that is needed has been misused by various entities on both sides of an issue, and even more so during the election cycle. These entities make allegations timed at influencing the election process, and oftentimes unfounded claims have real impacts on those that are involved. For all intents and practices, the APOC process has in some part been hijacked by those entities. The media and then the media influence that follows that turns the APOC process into a campaign tool, which it was never the intended purpose of this law. Therefore, Representative Higgins would urge your support of this timely needed legislation.
So basically, as I understand it, some candidate for some elective office, his opponent may file an ethics complaint. Not an ethics complaint, but an APOC complaint. And it may have merit and it may not have merit. Under this bill, today, as I understand it, that complaint would be made public. Is that correct?
Under the statutes as it exists today.
Today, right now.
That would become public information when it was given to APOC.
And any one of us who may have a candidacy for something, that would be out there on the street, is that correct?
Correct.
And then at some point, APOC would come to a conclusion on the merits of the bill and say, yes, he did, or no, he did not. That'd be made public. Meanwhile, if they found, quote, not guilty, unquote, that would be, that might be on the back page of the newspaper, but the original complaint could be on the front page.
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, that is the way it is today.
And so under this bill, as I understand it, the complaint, valid or not valid, could be made. APOC would investigate it. It was found not to have merit. That would be the end of it. Nobody would know about that. It was found to be valid, being a campaign just for the election, then that could be a headline of what APOC said he actually did. And that's... it would be public knowledge. Right. So people would vote one way or the other.
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct. What this does is, if you look at how we do our ethics complaints in the legislature and our ethics complaints in the executive branch, those are kept confidential until they have the findings, and then they're made public, along with the fines that may go with that particular violation. What we're looking for is conformity here, that would basically be the same case with this, is that it would be confidential until facts were known.
Ben, you had a question?
Well, I don't have a question as
or a
much.
Comment.
I have a comment and a question. So, what happens, and this is, I'm just going to tell you flat out, I don't really support the bill.
Okay.
Because I like the transparency that if a complaint is filed 4 days before the election, mm-hmm. and it proves to be true, and APOC doesn't act on it until after the election, and I'll, for example, I'll give you the Ted Stevens case.
Okay.
And so the allegation was out there, but and that was fine. But he lost the election. But what I worry about for us is if someone files a complaint, and it chooses it you know 3 or 4 days before the election, and APOC doesn't get to it till the day after the election, and it's found out to be true. That there was an ethical violation, the voters have then been bamboozled. I think the transparency, and I think the difference is when you're electing officials, you have a vote to make on the ethicalness of, if that's even a word, I feel like Sarah Palin right now. You have a right for the voters to be fully informed of your motives and what you're doing. I'm not a big fan of, if I didn't commit an ethical violation, I can defend myself. And I know there's frivolous ones that are done, there's tactics that both sides of the parties do all the time, but I think that to change this, we would be hiding from public scrutiny. And I don't want, I mean, me, of all people who's been scrutinized very much, I don't want to hide from that scrutiny. I want to be able to defend myself. And if the complaint is filed and until APOC comes up with a question, I can't go out there and defend myself because it's private. And if I have exact knowledge and proof that I can prove it immediately that it's not true, I want to be able to have that before APOC takes its time. And we all know how long APOC takes to get to an expedited hearing. So that's my concern. I think that we lose the transparency, and as my good friend from East Anchorage said, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. If you can't defend yourself against an ethical violation, then maybe your skin's not thick enough to be in the game. And so I'm just going to flat out tell you, I think that the reporting process that we have is tried and true, and people that have been falsely accused have the opportunity to prove themselves. When the complaint comes out, they can start an ad campaign, they can do whatever they want to prove themselves innocent. And so I'm not afraid of that. And I'm sure a lot of people differ in that opinion, but I think the more transparency that elected officials have, the better. And so, you know, when this bill came out, I'm not going to run from someone accusing me of something I didn't do. I'm going to run into it, and I'm going to defend myself immediately. And with this, I would have to wait. It would be confidential. It would be, you know, I'm sure as the gossip mills go, it would be going around. I wouldn't be able to say something. It would get out. It would be chatter under the breath and beasts, you know, those, what do they call the campaigns where the whisper campaigns are going along. I don't want to get into that. I don't want to get in that situation. That's just my opinion.
And of course, again, we're talking about APOC complaints, not ethics. Ethics is involved in the legislature.
Well, it would be an ethics complaint to APOC. I violated some APOC rule.
Yeah, but that's not ethics, I don't believe. That's violating.
It could be. It could be an unethical thing that, I mean.
What then we're doing?
No, I guess I wonder when we talk in terms of, well, it's unfair that somebody should be accused of something and then it turns out that it wasn't justified and they've had to undergo all of this publicity, et cetera. But I don't know how that differs from, I mean, when somebody is accused of a crime, I mean, headlines in the newspaper, and then 6 months later, maybe they're acquitted, but that's just one of those things that you have in an open and free society. Same thing goes for a lawsuit. We don't see the court records, and you can be accused of all sorts of awful things in a lawsuit, but they're open to the public looking at them. And yeah, as a public official, it's chances are that people are going to scrutinize something against us more so than they'd scrutinize something that isn't against a public figure, but you stole my line about the heat.
Sorry, it was so good.
I just have some problems with this.
Press 0. To enter a breakout session, press 1. For meeting admittance options, press 4. To mute your phone, press 5. For recording,
that was APOC.
Press 7. For advanced features, press 8. Okay. Exit the meeting and return to the main menu, press 9. To rejoin the meeting,
in session, and now we're back off session. At ease. Just can we please come back to order? Hopefully we have the technical problems solved. Okay, fine. Where were we when the song got messed up?
I was ranting.
But then you're ranting? Okay. What then good?
Mr. Chair, all I want to do actually right now before we move on is just kind of procedurally, I think we need to adopt the C version, is that correct?
Yeah, we do need to adopt State Affairs version.
Yeah, the State, so if it's okay, if I'm correct, I'll make the motion, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt for purposes of discussion CS for House Bill 235 State Affairs, which would be 28-LS1130-C, as a working document.
Okay. No objection. We're working on the State Affairs version. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The way I read that, I was under the impression that it was what was being kept confidential were the proceedings of APOC and the documents during the investigation, but that the person who's receiving the complaints, I didn't think that they were barred from being able to defend themselves publicly. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, that's absolutely true. You as the subject always have the right to waive that confidentiality. Mm-hmm. And we've actually, I've been working with the Department of Law, and it would be inappropriate for me to go into it now, but I have a CS that the ink is still wet on that actually goes into that so that you have that availability to waive that as the subject. So if Representative Millett, for instance, wanted to go head on into that, she would have every right to waive her right to confidentiality. What this bill does do is we have two processes in APOC. You have the normal process and then you have the expedited process. And in discussing that, within 72 hours, they're going to make a decision. The facts are going to be known more because they're not going to proceed with it in an expedited case unless they know what the facts are. APOC already said that they won't do that because that's how their process works. They have to know that those are that is a violation, that there's that they have strong belief that that there has been a violation, and then they're going to proceed on an expedited basis. If it's not been requested to be expedited, then they'll go under their normal one. But what we've done is we're looking at putting a finite timeline on that to make it so it is a timeline. I think what we're looking for is for those people that or whatever entity files a complaint with APOC that you at least have the opportunity to respond to that before your name is all over everywhere, because that's what happened. I'm not blaming the press. It's just that's the way it works. Somebody files a complaint and they run right down to the news media or whatever and going, I just filed a complaint on Representative Jones for filing a false complaint, and that's what gets in the headlines. Well, they technically did. They put the wrong date on their disclosure.
Right. I'm going to call on Representative Ledoux. Then, after that, we're going to hold the bill. We plan to do it anyway.
Right.
But I do want to get to the next bill, do something on the next bill before we adjourn. Time is flying. Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'm just wondering why we should make rules for ourselves, protecting ourselves from, you know, somebody saying something bad about us that we violated the APOC rules, when we don't make those rules for the general public who might be accused of a crime or be the subject of a civil lawsuit. I mean, I have a hard time understanding why we should protect ourselves when we're not protecting members of the general public. And that's not supposed to be rhetorical. I mean, I know it sounds rhetorical, but if you could respond to that, I'd really appreciate it.
You and I'll give us something to think about over the weekend here.
Yeah, well, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is a rhetorical question, but I think I
go to the rhetorical answer.
Yeah, well, it is a rhetorical answer. I think what this does is it's not a statute or a bill that's being done to protect you. It's being done to protect the process. When we established APOC, there was a process and a procedure that was put into place to ensure that those people who were elected to public office followed an ethical standard. What has happened is that has been taken aside and used for sensationalism, and in fact, the process is not being done the way it should be done. It's just not being followed with the way the process was done.
I don't think that APOC had anything to do with following ethical standards. I mean, APOC has to do with following certain rules that we said were that we put in place. I mean, taking $500 from a person versus taking $1,000 for a person. There's nowhere in the Bible or the Ten Commandments or anything that one is ethical and another isn't ethical. So those are like these man-made rules, whereas ethics is a totally different ball of wax.
Which, of course, we define here what ethics are supposed to be. This bill has potential both directions. So
absolutely.
That's a rhetorical observation here. So I want to thank you for bringing the bill before us. We'll hear from the sponsor, and maybe we can respond to some of these comments we've had today. So I'm going to hold this. He will make sure, and I'll bring the actual chair of the Judiciary Committee chooses to hear it again. And so with that, let's move on to 366. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, I didn't mean to
get me
into you.
So where are we in this bill here?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
How's your record? Still on record, so.
You're on record. Where's any appeared?
We have a new Y version. I would request, actually I'll ask Representative Ledoux if she wouldn't mind moving the Y version for our.
Yeah, I'd like to move the CS for House Bill 366 28-MS-1172 /Y for the committee's consideration.
Thank you. Well, without objection, we're voting on that. And
object for conversation.
Objection for discussion, conversation.
Yes.
And can you give me a copy of the bill, please? Yes. Any version? Okay, Reverend Miller.
No, I just objected
for
conversation.
Okay, anybody?
Yes.
Reverend
Miller. Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to just explain the changes from the last version to this version. First and foremost, the amendment that we adopted on Wednesday has been incorporated into this version.
Can you give us a brief explanation of what the differences are?
Yeah, no. So that amendment was adopted. That's the first change, where we deleted the four words that included health and social services. But the other change that was made was after a consultation with a Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives attorney. They indicated that we needed to change record of to resulting from in the bill, and I may have to ask Morgan to explain exactly where that is. I'm reading off of the legal memo that you probably all have from Ms. Strasbaugh, who is the drafter of this. I want to be clear, this is her kind of her terminology here. She changed the language concerning the court's role from may to shall as well. It was not clear that that was required by federal law, but apparently the attorney for Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or BAFTIF, or whatever their new name is, indicated that if we didn't make the change, that the person in Alaska would not be eligible for the relief of the disability. So basically, we wouldn't be able to get their name back off the record. So we're basically aligning ourselves. It's a very technical, just a technical move to just align ourselves with the federal law so we can make sure that that person still has the ability to have their name removed from the list. So long way to get about to. It's really kind of conforming and technical, but it was in association with that the Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms attorney.
And we had a discussion on that, yes.
Yep.
What else?
Those are it, Mr. Chair. I take that back. Other than that, there's also a couple of zero fiscal notes. There were some changes to a couple of fiscal notes. All that we have now is zero fiscal notes. That was the only other change that was made at this point.
Anybody online would like to testify? Could be on the room would like to testify.
Oh, sure.
You're not in the room.
But I was in the room.
Okay.
If I understand that. Through the chair, that Megan, you, Morgan, you have the letter from the Bureau of Alcohol. Do you have that with you? Through the chair.
Right. Ms. Morgan.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I did print off a copy of the email that where the representative from DPS notified me of the suggestions from that attorney. I have a printed off copy of the email in the room.
Through the chair.
Reverend Grunberg.
Whatever is being referred to by Ms. Strasbaugh in her March 21 memo, was that the email you're referring to?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, that was.
I wonder if we could get that distributed. I'd like to see what they said.
You do that rather quickly.
Do you have
the
legal opinion?
Yeah, I'm talking about the responding to the letter or email from the Bureau.
Oh. Yeah. That satisfied you,
Mr. Chair? And I was wondering, Mr. Chair, I was informed that the person from the Bureau was going to be on the line. Mm-hmm. Is that person available?
Mr. Prax? Okay, I have someone in the Department of Law, Stacy Crayley. I have Randall Burns, the Division of Behavioral Health, for questions. Dr. Ring from the Psych Institute, and all three of these are for questions only. I don't see anything here from the Bureau.
I was talking with Morgan just before the hearing today, and I thought that person from the Federal Bureau was going to be on the line, but I guess they're not.
Apparently not.
I'd at least like to see when they say here that the judge must grant relief rather than the may. It's probably okay, but you know we get all the time federal officials saying a certain law says something, and then we look at it and that's some interpretation of a federal law. And I'm just a little bit I guess I would say a show me. But if we don't have it, we don't have it.
We can represent it.
I don't want to hold the bill up or anything.
Yeah, I mean, we can make sure, Mr. Chair, that everyone has a copy. I think Ms. Howell from DPS can probably get us a copy of that. And I don't know if she or there's someone from, of course, DPS and the ATF work. I don't know if she's able to speak to that, so I don't want to put her on the spot, but...
Is anybody online here who can speak to Reverend Grinberg's comments?
Mr. Chair, I think a copy of that missing document may have been sent to Ms. Strasbaugh. I take it nobody has that document in the room or online. Is Ms. Strasbaugh online? Is she here?
Not that I... Ms. Strasbaugh, are you there? I don't think you are. She was online for the previous show.
Kathleen Strasbaugh, Legislative Legal Services.
Oh, very good. Did you hear Reverend Grinberg's comments or questions?
If the question is whether I reviewed the email before I conducted the drafting, the answer is yes.
Follow up. Ms. Strasbaugh, do you happen to have that email in front of you? Could at least you at least read it into the record or something?
I don't, because the bill file goes away when I get the bill typed up. So
can you give us a synopsis of what you remember it said?
Yes, and I actually spoke, as the memo reveals, I spoke with the attorney in question, and they wanted us to say resulting from rather than a record of, and we had built the bill around defining a concept called a record of disability related to and so on, and so we made changes associated with that, and we changed May to Cheryl as in the specified as Representative Grinberg noted, Mr. Chairman. And through the chair, Representative Grinberg, as we discussed, the problem in this situation is that it is our objective is to relieve our citizens from a disability created under federal law. So the interpretation the federal interpretation is rather critical in this situation, even if we're not sure we agree with it. So that's basically...
Believe in what your conversation, what you read in the email and so on, that the way the bill stands right now protects those who need to be protected?
I certainly hope so. I copied it exactly.
Okay. No comment.
Ms. Strasbaugh, this will allow for people that had a 30-day, I'm losing my train of thought, involuntary commitment, that they will be able to get off of the list. This is the enabling piece that will say, now that I've served and proved that I'm not mentally unfit to carry a handgun, this is what will enable them to get their name off of the list, correct?
Yes, that's the objective.
Thank you very much. Morgan, identify yourself again.
Through the chair, this is Morgan Hobson, staff to Representative Pruitt, and I would like to satisfy Representative Grinberg's request. I do have a copy of the email, and we would like to print off a clean copy of the original, but I could read the substance.
Mr. Chair, I would just ask that it be duplicated and distributed so we have it in our file. I don't want to take up time. I just want to...
Why don't you just read it?
Sure,
that way longer. Let's don't read it.
It looks like it's like 5 lines.
No. Go ahead and read it quickly.
So the first part that is underlined is the new text. So I'm reading the new text at this time. Page 3, lines 20 through 26, any person who is prohibited from possessing a firearm or ammunition under 18 U.S.C. 922G4 as a result of an adjudication or commitment that occurred in this state may at any time move to be relieved from the disabilities resulting from the adjudication or commitment. Now the deleted text bracket is... A person who has a record of an involuntary commitment to an adjudication, mental illness, or mental incompetence in a proceeding that this state, I believe that might be a typo, and who, because of the involuntary commitment or adjudication, was prohibited from possessing a firearm or ammunition under 18 U.S.C. 922 G4 may at any time move to be relieved from disability of a record of involuntary commitment or the adjudication of mental illness or mental incompetence. Next, very briefly, new text is shall, deleted text is may on page 4, line 9, of course. And that sums up the substance of the email.
The feds, right?
I beg your pardon?
The feds, we can you trust. Okay. I'm going to close public testimony at this point.
Mr. Chair.
Let's do this under discussion.
It was a question.
Do you have a question?
Thank you. I'm interested in the very last thing you read. And I would ask that, at least I would like a copy of that at some point.
You may give him a copy of that.
But the last thing was saying that they wanted us to say, to change on page 4, line 9, the word shall, the word may to shall. That was specifically in there. And I gather they did cite the federal statute earlier in that passage.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that is correct.
Okay, I'd just like a copy of it. That's fine. Thank you.
You may give him a copy of that. Okay, public testimony is closed. Bring the committee for discussion. Further discussion, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Speaker. Go ahead.
You have a question?
No, I was just going to move the bill.
Oh, that was what I was going to. Go ahead.
And you're faster.
Don't make the chairman choose between two ladies.
CS for House Bill 366, 28-LS1172/Y with individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes from committee.
Okay, with individual recommendation, did you get that?
I did.
Okay, fine. Without objection, the bill moves. Congratulations. Okay, the real chair of this committee planned to be back on Monday. I'd like to thank everybody for their work and helping me out through this process, and we are adjourned.